unlikely. After a moment, Justin said, without looking up, "Did he ever tell you about that time when he was 16? When his parents made him move school for the 10th time, or whatever it was?"
"No pasts," Daniel said.
"He wasn't trying to kill himself," Abby said. "He was trying to get some attention from his dickhead dad, and it didn't work."
"I said, no pasts."
"I'm not. I'm just saying this isn't the same, Justin. Hasn't Rafe been completely different these last few months? Hasn't he been way happier?"
"These last few months," Justin said.
"Not these last few weeks."
"Yeah, well," Abby said, and sliced an apple in half with a crisp snap.
"We've none of us been at our best. It's still not the same. Rafe knows he's got a home. He knows he's got people who care about him. He's not about to hurt himself. He's just having a hard time, and he's gone off to get hammered and chase Skirt. He'll be back when he's good and ready."
"What if he's..."
Justin's voice trailed off.
"I hate this, you know," he said softly to his plate. "I really hate this."
"Well, so do we all," said Daniel briskly. "It's been a trying time for all of us. We need to accept that and have patience with ourselves and with one another while we recover."
"You said to give it time and it would get better. It's not getting better, Daniel. It's getting worse."
"I was thinking," Daniel said, "of a little more time than 3 weeks. If you consider that unreasonable, then do by all means tell me."
"How can you be so calm?"
Justin wasn't far off tears.
"This is Rafe we're talking about."
"Whatever he's doing," Daniel said, turning his head politely to the side to blow smoke away from the rest of us. "I fail to see how it would make any difference if I became hysterical."
"I am not hysterical. This is how normal people react when one of their friends vanishes."
"Justin," Abby said gently, "it's going to be fine." But Justin didn't hear her.
"Just because you're a bloody robot, my God, Daniel, just once, I'd like to see you act as if you care about the rest of us, about anything."
"I think you have every reason to be aware," Daniel said coldly, "that I care very deeply about all four of you."
"I do not. What reason? I've got every reason to think that you don't give a damn."
Abby made a small gesture. Palm upturned to the ceiling, the room around us, the garden outside. There was something about it, about the way her hand fell back into her lap. Something tired, almost resigned.
"That's right,"
Justin said, slumping down in his chair. The light caught him at a cruel angle, hollowing out his cheeks and raking a long vertical groove between his eyebrows. And for a second, I saw like a time slip overlaid on his face, what he would look like in 50 years' time.
"Of course, the house. And look where that's got us."
There was a tiny, sharp silence.
"I have never claimed,"
Daniel said, and his voice had a dangerous depth of some emotion that I'd never heard there before,
"to be infallible. All I've ever claimed is that I try very hard to do what's best for the five of us. If you believe I'm doing such a bad job of it, feel free to make decisions of your own. If you think we shouldn't be living together, then move out. If you think we need to report Rafe missing, then pick up the phone."
After a moment, Justin shrugged miserably and went back to picking at his plate. Daniel smoked, gazing into the middle distance. Abby ate her apple. I turned my peach into puree. Nobody said anything for a long time.
"I see you've lost a ladyboy," Frank said when I rang him from my tree. We had apparently inspired him to have a health food moment. He was eating something with seeds. I could hear him spitting them attractively into his hand or wherever.
"If he turns up dead, then maybe everyone will start believing me about the mysterious stranger. I should have had money on it."
"Stop being a git, Frankie," I said.
Frank laughed. "You're not worried about him, are you? Seriously?"
I shrugged. I'd rather know where he is, that's all.
You can relax, babe.
A lovely young lady of my acquaintance was trying to find out where her friend Martin was this evening and just happened to dial little Rafe's number by mistake. Unfortunately, he didn't mention where he was before the misunderstanding got cleared up, but the background noise gave us a general idea. Abby was bang on, your boy's in a pub somewhere, getting gee-eyed and chasing the ladies. You'll get him back safe and sound except for a 5-star hangover.
So Frank had been worried too. Worried enough to dig out some woman floater with a sexy voice and get her making phone calls. Maybe Naylor hadn't been just a way for Frank to get at Sam. Maybe he had been serious about him as a suspect all along. I pulled my feet farther up into the branches.
Great, I said. That's good to know.
So how come you sound like your cat just died?
They're in bad shape, I said, and I was glad Frank couldn't see my face. I thought I was about to fall out of the tree from sheer exhaustion. I grabbed a branch and held on. For whatever reason, because they can't handle me getting stabbed or because they can't deal with whatever it is they're not telling us, they're coming apart at the seams.
After a moment, Frank said, very gently,
I know you're getting on well with them, babe. That's fine. They're not my cup of Earl Grey. But I've no objection to you feeling differently if it makes your job easier.
But they're not your mates. Their problems aren't your problems. They're your opportunities.
I know, I said. I know that. It's just hard to watch.
No harm in a bit of compassion, Frank said cheerfully, taking another big bite of whatever he was eating. As long as it doesn't get out of hand. I've got something to take your mind off their troubles, though. Your race's not the only one gone missing.
What are you talking about?
He spat out seeds.
I was planning on keeping tabs on Naylor from a safe distance. Get a handle on his routine, his associates, all the rest. Give you a little more to work with. But it's not turning out that way. He didn't show for work today. His parents haven't seen him since last night, and they say this is out of character. The father's in a wheelchair. It's not like John to leave his mammy to do the heavy lifting on her own. Your Sammy and a couple of floaters are taking turns sitting on his house, and we've told Byrne and Doherty to keep an eye out, for whatever that's worth.
He won't go far, I said. This guy wouldn't leave Glenskeehy unless he was dragged away kicking and screaming. He'll turn up.
Yeah, that's what I figure. As far as the stabbing goes, I don't think this cuts one way or the other. It's a myth that only the guilty ones run. But here's one thing I do know. Whatever has Naylor running, it's not fear. Did he look scared to you?
No, I said. Not for a second. He looked furious.
To me, too. He wasn't one bit happy about that interview. I watched him leave afterwards. 2 steps from the door, he turned around and spat at it. That's one very pissed off bogger, Cassie, and we already know he's got a temper problem. And like you said, he's probably still in the area. I don't know whether he's gone missing because he doesn't want us surveilling him, or because he's got something up his sleeve, or what. But watch yourself.
I did. All the way home, I kept to the middle of the lanes, with my gun cocked and ready in my hands. I didn't put it back into my girdle until the back gate had clanged behind me, and I was safe in the garden, at the edge of the bright tracks of light from the windows. I hadn't rung Sam. This time it wasn't because I'd forgotten. It was because I had no idea whether he would answer, or what either of us would have to say if he did. Chapter 17. Rafe showed up in the library the next morning, around 11, with his coat buttoned wrong and his knapsack swinging carelessly from one hand. He stank of cigar smoke and stale Guinness, and he was still pretty unsteady on his feet.
Well, he said, swaying a little and surveying the four of us. Hello, hello, hello.
Where have you been? Daniel hissed. His voice had a tense edge of anger, barely suppressed. He had been a lot more worried about Rafe than he had let on.
Here and there, Rafe told him. Out and about. How are you?
We thought something had happened to you. Justin's whisper cracked into something too loud and too sharp.
Why didn't you ring us, even text us?
Rafe turned to look at him.
I was otherwise
occupied, he said, after considering this. And I didn't feel like it. One of the goon squad, the mature students who always appoint themselves the library noise vigilantes, looked up over his stack of philosophy books and went, "Shh." "Your timing sucks," Abby said coldly. This was not a good moment to take off on a skirt hunt, and even you should have been able to figure that out. Rafe rocked backwards on his heels and gave her a deeply miffed look. "Fuck you," he said loudly and haughtily. "I'll decide, when I do, what I want." "Don't talk to her like that any more," Daniel said. He didn't even pretend to care about keeping his voice down. The entire goon squad went, "Shh," at once. I tugged at Rafe's sleeves. "Sit down here and talk to me." "Lexi," Rafe said, managing to focus on me. His eyes were bloodshot and his hair needed washing. "I shouldn't have left you on your own, should I?" "I'm fine," I said. "I'm a happy camper. Want to sit down and tell me how your night went?" He stretched out a hand. His fingers trailed down my cheek, my throat, slipped along the neckline of my top. I saw Abby's eyes widen behind him, heard a quick rustle from Justin's carol. "God, you're so sweet," Rafe said. "You're not as delicate as you look, are you? Sometimes I think the rest of us are the other way around." One of the goon squad had dug up Attila, who was the narkiest security guard in the known universe. He obviously went into the job in the hope of getting to crack the heads of dangerous criminals. But since these are thin on the ground in your average college library, he gets his kicks by making lost freshers cry. "Is this fella giving you any bother?" he asked me. He was trying to loom over Rafe, but the height difference was giving him trouble. The wall went up straight away. Daniel and Abby and Justin snapped into attitudes of cool, poised ease. Even Rafe straightened up and whipped his hand away from me and managed to look instantly, effortlessly sober. "Everything's fine," Abby said. "I didn't ask you," Attila told her. "Do you know this fella?" "He was talking to me." I gave him an angelic smile and said, "Actually, officer, he's my husband. I did have a barring order against him, but now I've changed my mind, and we're off to shag deliriously in the ladies." Rafe started to snicker. "There's no fellas allowed in the ladies," said Attila ominously, "and yous are causing a disturbance."
"It's all right," Daniel said. He stood up and took Rafe by the upper arm. The grip looked casual, but I could see his fingers digging in hard. "We were just leaving. All of us."
"Get off me,"
Rafe snapped, trying to shrug off Daniel's hand. Daniel steered him briskly past Attila and down the long aisle of books without looking back to see if the rest of us were following. We gathered up our stuff, left in a hurry through Attila's awful warnings, and found Daniel and Rafe in the foyer. Daniel was swinging his car keys from one finger. Rafe was leaning lopsidedly against a pillar and sulking.
"Well done," Abby said to Rafe. "Really, that was classy."
"Don't start." "But what are we doing?" Justin asked Daniel. He was carrying Daniel's stuff as well as his own. He looked worried and overloaded.
"We can't just leave."
"Why not?"
There was a brief, taken aback silence. Our routine was so ingrained, I think it had stopped occurring to any of us that it wasn't actually a law of nature, that we could break it if we wanted to.
"What do we do instead?" I asked.
Daniel threw the car keys into the air and caught them.
"We're going to go home and paint the sitting room," he said. "We've been spending far too much time in that library. A bit of work on the house will do us all good."
To any outsider, this would have sounded deeply weird. I could hear Frank in my head.
"God, they're rock and roll. How do you stand the pace?"
But everyone nodded, even after a moment, Rafe. I had already noticed that the house was their safe zone. Whenever things got tense, one of them would steer the conversation onto something that needed fixing or rearranging, and everyone would settle down again.
We were going to be in big trouble once the house was all sorted out, and we didn't have grouting or floor stains to use as our happy place. It worked, too. Old sheets thrown over the furniture, and cold bright air flooding through the open windows. Crap clothes and hard work, and the smell of paint. Ragtime playing in the background. The naughty buzz of ditching college and the house swelling like an approving cat under the attention. It was exactly what we needed. By the time we finished the room, Rafe was starting to look sheepish instead of belligerent. Abby and Justin had relaxed enough to have a long, comfortable argument about whether Scott Joplin sucked, and we were all in a much better mood. "First dibs in the shower," I said.
"Let Rafe have it," said Abby. "To each according to his need."
Rafe made a face at her. We were sprawled on the dust sheets, admiring our work and trying to get up the energy to move. "Once this dries," Daniel said, "we'll need to decide what, if anything, we're putting on the walls."
"I saw these really old tin signs," said Abby, "up in the top spare room." "I am not living in a 1980s pub," said Rafe.
He had sobered up along the way, or else the paint fumes had got the rest of us high enough that we didn't notice.
"Aren't there paintings or something normal?"
"The ones that are left are all horrible," Daniel said. He was leaning back against the edge of the sofa, with spatters of white paint in his hair, and on his old plaid shirt, looking happier, and more at ease than he had in days. "Landscape with stag and hounds, that kind of thing, and not particularly well done, either. Some great-great-aunt with artistic pretensions, I think."
"You've got no soul," Abby told him. "Things with sentimental value aren't supposed to have artistic merit as well. They're supposed to be crap, otherwise it's just showing off."
"Let's use those old newspapers," I said.
I was flat on my back in the middle of the floor, waving my legs in the air to examine the new paint splashes on Lexi's work dungarees.
"The ancient ones, with the article about the Dione quintuplets and the ad for the thing that makes you gain weight. We can stick them all over the walls and varnish over them, like the photos on Justin's door."
"That's in my bedroom," Justin said. "A sitting room should have elegance, grandeur, not ads."
"You know," Rafe said out of the blue, propping himself up on one elbow, "I do realize that I owe all of you an apology. I shouldn't have vanished, especially not without letting you know where I was. My only excuse, and it's not much of a one, is that I was deeply pissed off about that guy getting off scot-free. I'm sorry." He was at his most charming, and Rafe could be very charming when he felt like it.
Daniel gave him a grave little nod.
"You're an idiot," I said, "but we love you anyway."
"You're okay," Abby said, stretching up to get her cigarettes off the card table. "I'm not crazy about the idea of that guy running around loose either."
"You know what I wonder?" Rafe said. "I wonder if Ned hired him to frighten us off."
There was an instant of absolute silence. Abby's hand stopped with a smoke halfway out of the pack. Justin froze in the middle of sitting up. Daniel snorted.
"I seriously doubt that Ned has the intellect for anything that complex," he said acidly.
I had opened my mouth to ask, "Who's Ned?" But I had shut it again, fast. Not just because I was obviously supposed to know this, but because I did. I could have kicked myself for not seeing it earlier. Frank has always thrown diminutives at people he doesn't like. Danny Boy, our Sammy. And like an idiot, I had never considered the possibility that he might have picked the wrong one. They were talking about Slow Eddie. Slow Eddie, who had been wandering around the late night laneways looking for someone, who had claimed he had never met Lexi, was N. I was sure Frank could hear my heart punch in the mic.
"Probably not," Rafe said, lying back on his elbows and contemplating the walls. "When we're done here, we should really invite him over for dinner."
"Over my dead body," said Abby. Her voice was tightening up. "You didn't have to deal with him, we did."
And mine, said Justin. The man's a Philistine. He drank Heineken all night, of course. And then he kept belching, and naturally, he thought that was hilarious every single time. And all that droning about fitted kitchens and tax breaks and section whatever it is. Once was enough, thank you very much.
You people have no heart, Rafe told him. Ned loves this house. He told the judge so. I think we owe him a chance to see that the old family seat is in good hands. Give me a smoke.
The only thing Ned loves, Daniel said very sharply, is the thought of 6 fully fitted executive apartments on extensive grounds with potential for further development. And over my dead body, will he ever get a chance to see that? Justin made a sudden jerky movement, covered it by reaching for an ashtray and shoving it across to Abby. There was a complicated, sharp-edged silence. Abby lit her smoke, shook out the match and threw the packet to Rafe, who caught it one-handed. Nobody was looking at anybody. An early bumblebee blundered in at the window, hovered over the piano in a slant of sun, and eventually bumped back out again. I wanted to say something. That was my job, diffuse in moments like this one. But I knew we had veered into some kind of treacherous and complicated swamp where one misstep could get me into big trouble. Ned was sounding like more and more of a wank stain. Even if I didn't have the first clue what an executive apartment was, I got the general idea. But whatever was going on ran a lot deeper and darker than that. Abby was watching me over her cigarette with cool, curious grey eyes. I shot her an agonized look, which didn't take much effort. After a moment, she searched for the ashtray and said, If there's nothing decent to put up on the walls, maybe we should try something different. Rafe, if we found photos of old murals, do you think you could do something like that? Rafe shrugged. An edge of the belligerent don't blame me look was creeping back onto his face. That dark electric cloud had come down over the room again. Silence was fine with me. My mind was doing cartwheels. Not just because Lexi had for some reason been hanging out with the arch enemy, but because Ned was clearly a taboo subject. For 3 weeks, his name had never been mentioned. The first reference to him had fried everyone's heads, and I couldn't figure out why. He had lost, after all. The house was Daniel's. Both Uncle Simon and a judge had said so. Ned should have triggered nothing more serious than a laugh and a few snide comments. I would have sold a major organ to find out what the hell was going on here, but I knew a lot better than to ask. As it turned out, I didn't have to. Frank's mind, and I wasn't at all sure I liked this, had run parallel to mine, parallel and fast. I went for my walk as early as I could. That cloud hadn't dissipated. If anything, it had got thicker, pressing in from the walls and ceilings. Dinner had been painful. Justin and Abby and I had done our best to be chatty, but Rafe had gone into a sour sulk that you could practically see. And Daniel had withdrawn into himself, answering questions in monosyllables. I needed to get out of that house and think. Lexi had met up with Ned at least 3 times, and she'd gone to a lot of trouble to do it. The 4 big L's of motive: lust, lucre, loathing, and love. The chance of lust made my gag reflex kick in. The more I heard about Ned, the more I wanted to believe that Lexi wouldn't have touched him with someone else's. Lucre, though. She had needed money, fast. And a rich boy like Ned would have made a way better buyer than John Naylor and his crap farm job. If she had been meeting Ned to discuss what knick-knacks he might want from Whitethorn House, how much he would be willing to pay, and then something had gone wrong. It was a very strange night. Huge and dark and gusty. Snaps of wind roaring across the hillsides. 1,000,000 high stars and no moon. I stuffed my gun back into my girdle, climbed up my tree and spent a long time there, watching the shadowy black surge of the bushes below me, listening hard for any faint sound that didn't belong, thinking
about phoning Sam. In the end, I phoned Frank.
Naylor hasn't shown up yet, he said.
No hello.
You keeping an eye out?
Yeah, I said. No sign of him as far as I can tell.
Right.
There was an absent note to his voice that told me his mind wasn't on Naylor either.
Good. Meanwhile, I've got something that might interest you. You know the way your new pals were bitching about Cousin Eddie and his executive apartments this afternoon?
For a second, all my muscles jolted awake, till I remembered Frank didn't know about N.
Yep, I said. Cousin Eddie sounds like a right little gem. Oh yeah, 100% pure brain dead yuppie fuck. Never had a thought in his life that didn't involve his dick or his wallet.
You think Rafe was right about him hiring Naylor?
Not a chance. Eddie doesn't hobnob with the lower classes. You should have seen his face when he heard my accent. I think he was afraid I was going to mug him.
But this afternoon reminded me.
Remember how you said the Fantastic Four were weird about the house? Too attached?
Oh, I said.
Yeah.
I had almost forgotten that, actually. I think I overreacted. When you put a lot of work into a place, you do get attached to it. And it's a nice house.
Oh, it is, Frank said.
There was something in his tone that set my alarm bells jingling faintly. A fierce, sardonic grin.
It is that. I was bored today. Naylor's still in the wind, and I'm getting nowhere on Lexi, May, Ruth, Princess Anastasia, whoever. I've drawn a blank in about 14 countries so far. I'm considering the possibility that she was built in a pod by mad scientists in 1997. So, just to show my homegirl Cassie that I trust her instincts, I put in a call to my mate in the Land Registry office and ask him for a rundown on Whitethorn House. Who loves you, baby?
You do, I said. Frank has always had a spectacular array of mates in unlikely places. My mate down at the docks, my mate on the county council, my mate who runs the S&M shop. Back when we first began this whole Lexi Madison thing, my mate at births, deaths and marriages made sure she was officially registered, in case anyone got suspicious and started sniffing around. While my mate with the van helped me move into her bedsit. I figure I'm happier not knowing about whatever complex barter system is going on there.
You bloody well should after all this, and?
And remember saying they all act like they own the place.
Yeah, I guess. Your instincts hit the jackpot, babe. They do. So do you, actually.
Quit being cute, Frankie, I said. My heart was pounding hard and slow, and there was a strange dark shiver through the hedges. Something was happening.
What are you on about? Old Simon's will cleared probate, and Daniel took possession of Whitethorn House on the 10th of September. On the 15th of December, ownership of the house was transferred into five names. Raphael Highland, Alexandra Madison, Justin Mannerin, Daniel March, and Abigail Stone. Happy Christmas.
It was the sheer, blazing courage of it that hit me first. The passion of trust it would take. To put your future where your mouth was. No half measures. Scoop up all your tomorrows and put them so deliberately, so simply, in the hands of the people you loved best. I thought of Daniel at the table, broad-backed and solid in his crisp white shirt. The precise flick of his wrist as he turned a page. Of Abby flipping bacon in her bathrobe. Justin singing out of tune while he got ready for bed. Rafe sprawled on the grass, squinting up into the sun. And all the time, underpinning everything, this. I had had moments of envy in them before. But this was something too deep for envy. Something like awe. And then I realized, N, plane fares, over my dead body will Ned get a chance. Here I had been fucking about with music boxes and tin soldiers and trying to figure out how much your average family photo album was worth. Here I had thought she had nothing to sell, this time. If she had been negotiating with Ned and the others had somehow found out,
Holy shit. No wonder his name had turned the room to ice that afternoon. I couldn't breathe. Frank was still going. I could hear him moving, pacing up and down the room, fast steps. The paperwork on that would take months. Danny Boy must have started it almost the same day he got the keys. I know you like these people, Cassie, but you can't tell me that's not bizarre as all hell. That house is worth a cool couple of million, easy. What the fuck is he thinking? They're all going to live there forever in one big happy hippie commune. Actually, never mind what he's thinking. What the fuck is he smoking? He was taking it personally because he had missed it. All that investigation and the middle-class student wimps had somehow slipped this right past him. Yeah, I said very carefully. It's weird. They are weird, Frank. And yeah, it's going to get complicated down the road when someone wants to get married or whatever. But like you said yourself, they're young. They're not thinking that way yet.
Yeah, well, little Justin won't be getting married anytime soon. Not without a major change in the legislation.
Stop being a cliche, Frank. What's the big deal? This didn't mean it had to be one of the four of them. Not necessarily. The evidence still added up to Lexi being stabbed by someone she had met outside the house. It didn't even mean she had actually been going to sell. If she had made a deal with Ned and then changed her mind, told him she was backing out. If she had just been playing with him all along, loathing. Yanking his chain to pay him back for trying to take the house. He had wanted Whitethorn House badly enough to spit on his grandfather's memory. What would he have done if a share of it had been so close he could taste it, and then Lexi had snatched it away? I tried to shove the diary out of my mind. Those dates. The first N just a few days after that missing circle. The hard scribble. Pen almost digging through the paper. That said, she hadn't been playing.
Well, Frank said with the lazy note to his voice that means he's at his most dangerous. If you ask me, this could give us the motive we've been looking for. Me? I'd call that a big deal.
No, I said promptly. Maybe too promptly. But Frank didn't comment. Not a chance. Where's the motive in that? If they all wanted to sell and she was blocking it, then maybe. But those four would rather pull out their own teeth with rusty pliers than sell that house. What have they got to gain by killing her?
One of them dies. His share, or hers, reverts back to the other four. Maybe someone figured a quarter of that lovely big house would be even nicer than a fifth. It more or less lets Danny Boy out. If he wanted the whole thing, he could have just kept it to start with. But that still leaves us with three little Indians.
I wriggled round the other way on my branch. I was very glad that Frank was off target. But illogically, the extent to which he didn't get it was pissing me off.
What for? Like I said, they don't want to sell it. They want to live in it. They can do that just as well, no matter what percentage they own. You think one of them killed her because he liked her bedroom better than his own? Or her own. Abby's a good kid, but I'm not ruling her out. Or maybe it wasn't financial, for once. Maybe Lexi was just plain driving someone nuts. People share a house, they get on each other's tits. And remember, there's a very good chance she was shagging one of the lads. And we all know how nasty that can turn. If you're renting, no big deal. Some yelling, a few tears, a house meeting, one of you moves out. But what do you do if it's a co-owner? They can't throw her out. I doubt any of them can afford to buy her out.
Sure, I said. Except I haven't got one single whiff of any kind of major tension aimed at me. Rafe was pissed off with me at first for not realizing how shaken up they all were, but that's it. If Lexi had been getting up someone's nose to the point of murder, there's no way I could have missed it. These people like each other, Frank. They may be weird, but they like being weird together.
So why didn't they tell us they all owned the place? Why are they being so fucking secretive, unless they're hiding something?
They didn't tell you, because you never asked them. If you were in their place, even if you were innocent as a baby, would you give the cops anything you didn't have to? Would you even spend hours answering questions the way they have?
You know what you're talking like, Frank said,
after a pause. He had stopped pacing. You're talking like a defense attorney. I twisted round the other way again, swung my feet up against a branch. I was having a hard time staying still.
Oh, come on, Frank. I'm talking like a detective, and you're talking like a fucking obsessive. If you don't like these four, that's fine. If they twang your antennae, that's fine too. But it doesn't mean that every single thing you find is automatically evidence that they're stone-cold killers. I don't think you're in any position to question my objectivity, babe.
Frank said. That lazy drawl had come back into his voice, and it made my back tense up against the tree trunk.
What the hell is that supposed to mean? It means I'm on the outside keeping my perspective, while you're neck deep in all the action, and I'd like you to keep that in mind. It also means I think there's a limit to how far, oh, they're just charmingly eccentric, will go as an excuse for acting downright bloody squarely. What brought this on, Frank? You've counted them out since the beginning. 2 days ago you were all over Naylor like a rash. And I still am, or I will be as soon as we find that little bastard again. But I like spreading my bets. I'm not dropping anyone, anyone at all, until they're definitively ruled out. And these four haven't been. Don't forget that.
It was way past time for me to back off. Fair enough, I said. Until Naylor turns up again, I'll focus on them.
You do that. So will I. And keep watching yourself, Cassie. Not just outside that house. Inside, too. Talk tomorrow.
And he was gone. The fourth big L. Love. I thought, suddenly, of the phone videos. A picnic on Bray Head, the summer before. All of them lying on the grass, drinking wine out of plastic cups, and eating strawberries and arguing lazily over whether Elvis was overrated. Daniel had gone into a long, absorbed monologue about socio-cultural context. Until Rafe and Lexi decided everything was overrated except Elvis and chocolate, and started throwing strawberries at him. They had been passing the camera phone around. The clips were disjointed and shaky. Lexi with her head in Justin's lap, and him tucking a daisy behind her ear. Lexi and Abby sitting back to back and looking out at the sea, hair blowing, shoulders lifting in long, matching breaths. Lexi laughing up into Daniel's face as she picked a ladybug out of his hair and held it out. Him bending his head over her hand and smiling. I had seen the video so many times that it felt like my own memory, flickering and sweet. They had been happy that day, all five of them. There had been love there. It had looked solid and simple as bread, real. And it felt real to live in, a warm element through which we moved easily and which we breathed in with every breath. But Lexi had been ready and willing to blow all that sky high. More than willing, hell bent on it. That furious scrawl in the date book, while the phone video showed her climbing down from the attic laughing and covered in dust. If she had lived a couple of weeks longer, the others would have woken up one morning and found her gone. Not a note, not a goodbye, not a second thought. It slid through a back corner of my mind that Lexi Madison had been dangerous, under that bright surface, and that maybe she still was. I slid off my branch, hanging by my hands, dropped and landed in the lane with a thump. I dug my hands into my pockets and started walking. Moving helps me think. The wind pulled at my cap and shoved into the small of my back, almost taking me off my feet. I needed to talk to Ned, fast. Lexi had neglected to leave me instructions on how the hell they got in touch with each other. Not by mobile. Sam had pulled her phone records first thing. No unidentified numbers in or out. Carrier pigeon. Notes in the hollow tree. Smoke signals. I didn't have much time. Frank had no idea that Lexi had ever met Ned, and no idea that she'd been getting ready to blow town. I knew there would turn out to be a good reason why I didn't want to tell him about that diary. Just like he always says, your instincts work faster than your mind. But he wasn't about to let go of this. He would worry away at it like a pit bull, and sooner or later he was going to hit on this same possibility. I didn't know all that much about Ned, but enough to be pretty sure that if he ended up in an interview room with Frank going at him full throttle, he would spill his guts inside 5 minutes. It never once occurred to me, not for a second, to sit back and let that happen. Whatever had been going on here, I needed to put my finger on it before Frank did. If I wanted to make an appointment to meet Ned without any chance of the others finding out, how would I do it? No phones. Mobiles keep a call register and they get itemized bills. She wouldn't have left anything like that lying around, and Whitethorn House didn't have a landline. There was no payphone within walking distance, and the ones in college were risky. The arts block phones were the only ones close enough to use on a fake bathroom break. And if one of the others had happened to walk by me at the wrong moment, she would have been fucked. And this was too important for gambles. No calling in to see him either. Frank had said Ned lived in Bray and worked in Killiney. There was no way she could have got there and back without the others missing her. And no letters or emails. She would never, not in a million years, have left a trail. How the hell, girl? I said softly into the air. I felt her like a shimmer over my shadow on the lane. The tilt of her chin and the mocking sideways flash of her eyes. Not telling. Somewhere along the way, I had stopped noticing just how seamlessly conjoined their five lives were. Into college together, all day in the library together, smoke break at noon with Abby, and at four with Rafe. Lunch together at one, home together for dinner. The routine of it was choreographed as precisely and tightly as a gavotte. Never a minute left unaccounted for, and never a minute to myself except... except now. For 1 hour a night, like some spellbound girl in a fairy tale, I unwound my life from the others, and it was all my own again. If I were Lexi, and I wanted to contact someone I should never have been contacting, I would use my late-night walk. Not would. Had. For weeks now, I had been using it to phone Frank, phone Sam, keep my secrets safe. A fox skittered across the lane in front of me and vanished into the hedge, all bones and luminous eyes, and a shiver went down my back. Here I had thought this was my very own bright idea. I was making my own way step by step and alert through the dark. It was only now, when I turned around and looked back down the road, that I realized I had been blithely, blindly, putting my feet smack in Lexi's footprints all the way. So, I said aloud like a challenge, so what? This was what Frank had sent me in for, to get close to the victim, get into her life, and, duh, I was doing it. A certain amount of creepy was not only beside the point, but also pretty much par for the course on a murder investigation. They're not supposed to be one long round of laughs. I was getting spoiled. All these cozy candlelight dinners and handicrafts, turning jumpy when reality kicked back in. 1 hour to get hold of Ned. How? Notes in the hollow tree. I almost laughed out loud. Professional defamation. You've got the most esoteric possibilities all worked out. It's the simple ones that take forever to hit you. The higher the stakes, Frank once told me, the lower the technology. If you want to meet your mate for coffee, you can afford to arrange it by text message or email. If you think the cops or the mob or the Illuminati are closing in, you signal your contact with a blue towel on the washing line. For Lexi, days ticking away and morning sickness starting to kick in. The stakes must have felt like life and death. Ned lived in Bray, only a 15-minute drive away, outside rush hour. Probably she had taken the risk of phoning him from college the first time. After that, all she had needed was a safe drop spot, somewhere in these lanes that both of them could check every couple of days. I must have walked straight past it a dozen times. That shimmer again, in the corner of my eye, tip of a grin, there and tricky, and then gone. In the cottage? The bureau gang had been all over it like flies on shite, dusted every inch for prints and found nothing. And he hadn't been parked anywhere near the cottage that night I'd followed him.
allowing a little leeway for the fact that God forbid you should drive your monster truck on the kind of roads for which it was constructed. He would have parked as close to the drop spot as he could get. He had been on the main Rathowen Road, nowhere near any turnoff. Wide verges, long grass and brambles. The dark road dropping away over the brow of the hill and the milestone, worn and leaning like a tiny grave marker. I hardly realized I had turned around and was running hard. The others would be expecting me back any minute, and the last thing I wanted was for them to get worried and come looking for me. But this couldn't wait till tomorrow night. I wasn't racing some hypothetical, infinitely flexible deadline anymore. I was racing against Frank's mind and Lexi's. After the narrow lanes, the verge felt wide and bare and very exposed, but the road was deserted. Not a glimmer of headlights in either direction. When I pulled out my torch, the letters on the stone marker jumped out at me, blurred with time and weather, throwing their own slanted shadows. Glenskihe, 1828. The grass swirled and bent around it in the high wind, with a sound like a long hiss of breath. I caught the torch under my arm and parted the grass with both hands. It was wet and sharp-edged, tiny serrations pulling at my fingers. At the foot of the stone, something flashed crimson. For a moment, my mind couldn't take in what I was seeing. Sunk deep in the grass, colors glowed bright as jewels and minute figures scudded away from the torchlight. Gloss of a horse's flank, flick of a red coat, toss of powdered curls and a dog's head turning as he leaped for cover. Then my hand touched wet, gritty metal, and the figures shivered and clicked into place, and I laughed out loud, a small gasp that sounded strange even to me. A cigarette tin, old and rusty, and probably nicked from Uncle Simon's stash. The rich, battered hunting scene was painted with a brush fine as an eyelash. The bureau and the floaters had done a fingertip search for a mile around the cottage, but this was outside their perimeter. Lexi had beaten them. Save this for me. The note was on lined paper torn out of some kind of Filofax thing. The handwriting looked like a 10-year-old's, and apparently Ned hadn't been able to decide whether he was writing a business letter or a text message. Dear Lexi, been trying to get a hold of you in reference to that matter we were talking about. I'm still VV interested. Please let me know whenever you get a chance. Thanks, Ned. I was willing to bet that Ned had gone to an insanely expensive private school. Daddy hadn't exactly got his money's worth. Dear Lexi, thanks, Ned. Lexi must have wanted to kick him for leaving that kind of thing lying around, no matter how well hidden. I took out my lighter, moved over to the road and set the note on fire. When it caught, I dropped it, waited for the quick flare to die down and crushed out the embers with my foot. Then I found my biro and ripped a page out of my notebook. By this stage, Lexi's handwriting came easier than my own. 11, Thursday. Talk then. No need for fancy bait. Lexi had done all that for me. This guy was already well hooked. The tin shut with a neat tiny click, and I tucked it back into the long grass, feeling my fingerprints overlaying themselves perfectly on Lexi's. My feet planted carefully in the precise spots where her footprints had long since washed away. Chapter 18. The next day lasted about a week. The arts block was too hot, dry and airless. My tutorial group were bored and fidgety. It was their last session. They hadn't read the material and couldn't be bothered to fake it, and I couldn't be bothered pretending I cared. All I could think about was Ned. Whether he would show, what I would say if he did, what I would do if he didn't, how long I had before Frank caught up with us. I knew that night was a long shot. Even assuming I was right about the cottage being their meeting place, Ned might easily have given up on Lexi altogether after a month with no communication. He hadn't dated his note. It could have been weeks old. And even if he was the persistent type, the odds were against him checking the drop spot in time to make the meeting. A big part of me hoped he wouldn't. I needed to hear what he had to say, but anything I heard, Frank was going to hear too. I got to the cottage early, around 10:30.
At home, Rafe was playing Stormy Beethoven with an awful lot of pedal. Justin was trying to read with his fingers in his ears. Everyone was getting snippier by the minute, and the whole thing showed every sign of spiraling into a vicious argument. It was only the third time I had been inside that cottage. I was a little wary about angry farmers. The field had to belong to someone after all, although apparently he wasn't too attached to it. But it was a still, bright night, nothing moving for miles around, just pale, empty fields, and the mountains black silhouettes against the stars. I got my back into a corner where I could see the field and the road, but where the shadows would mask me from anyone watching, and waited. Just on the off chance that Ned did show up, I had to get this right. I only had one shot. I needed to let him lead, not just on everything I said, but on how I said it. Whatever Lexi had been for him, I needed to be the same. Going on past form, that could have been anything. Breathy vamp, brave put-upon Cinderella, enigmatic Mata Hari. And regardless of what Frank said about Ned's brain power, if I hit the wrong note, even he would probably notice. All I could do was play it quiet and hope he gave me some cue. The road was white and mysterious, curling away downhill into deep black hedges. A few minutes before 11, there was a vibration somewhere. Too deep or too far away to pinpoint. Just a throb tugging at the edge of my hearing. Silence. Then, the faint crunch of footsteps, away down the lane. I pressed back into the corner and got one hand around my torch and the other up my sweater, on the butt of my gun. That flash of fair hair moving among the dark hedges. Ned had made it after all. I let go of my gun and watched him haul himself awkwardly over the wall, inspect his trousers for contamination, brush off his hands, and pick his way across the field with deep distaste. I waited till he was in the cottage, only a few feet away, before I switched on my torch. "God!" Ned said peevishly, throwing an arm up to shield his eyes. "Like, go ahead and totally blind me." That right there was, like, totally enough for me to learn everything I needed to know about Ned in one easy lesson. Here I had been all freaked out about having one double. He must have run into a clone of himself on every street corner in South Dublin. He was so exactly like everyone else that there was no way to see him through all those thousands of reflected images. Standard-issue trendy haircut, standard-issue good looks, standard-issue rugby build, standard-issue overpriced labels. I could have told you his whole life story on that one glance. I hope to God I never had to pick him out of a lineup. Lexi would have given him whatever he wanted to see, and there was no doubt in my mind that Ned liked his girls cliched. Sexy by numbers rather than by nature. Humorless. Not too bright, and ever so slightly bitchy. It was a shame I didn't have a fake tan. "Oh my God," I said, matching his peeved tone and doing the same geebag accent I'd used to get Naylor out of his hedge. "Don't have a thrombo, it's just a torch." This conversation wasn't starting out on a great note, but I was okay with that. There are some social circles where manners are a sign of weakness. "Where have you been?" Ned demanded. "I've been leaving you notes like every other day. I've got better stuff to do than haul my arse down to Bogland all the time, yeah?" If Lexi had been shagging this space waste, I was going to head over to the morgue and stab her myself. I rolled my eyes. "Hello? I got stabbed. I was in a coma." "Oh," Ned said. "Yeah, right." He gave me a pale blue, vaguely put out stare, like I'd done something tasteless. "Still though, you could have got in touch. This is business." That at least was good news. "Yeah, well," I said, "we're in touch now, aren't we?" "This total fucking low-life detective came and talked to me," Ned said, suddenly remembering. He looked as outraged as you can get without changing expression. "Like I was a suspect or something. I told him this was so not my problem. I'm not from Ballymun. I don't stab people." I decided I was with Frank on this one, Ned was not the brightest little bunny hopping through the forest. He was the type who was basically one big cluster of second-hand reflexes. No actual thought involved. I would have been willing to bet good money that he talked to working-class clients as though they were handicapped and said, "Me love you, long time," whenever he saw an Asian girl. "Did you tell him about this?" I asked, pulling myself up onto a broken bit of wall. He gave me a horrified look. "No way! He'd have been all over me like a rash, and I couldn't be arsed trying to explain myself to him. I just want this sorted, yeah?" And civic-minded too, not that I was complaining. "Good," I said. "I mean, it's not like this has anything to do with what happened to me, right?" Ned didn't seem to have an opinion on that. He went to lean against the wall, examined it suspiciously, and changed his mind. "So can we, like, move forwards?" he wanted to know. I ducked my head and threw him a sideways poor little me glance. Up under the lashes. "The coma totally messed up my memory, so you'll have to tell me where we were and stuff." Ned stared at me. That impassive face, utterly expressionless, giving away nothing. For the first time, I saw a resemblance to Daniel, even if it was Daniel after a frontal lobotomy. "We were on 100, he said after a moment. "Cash." 100 quid for some family heirloom? 100 grand for a share of the house? I didn't have to be sure what we were talking about to know he was lying. I don't think so, I told him, giving him a flirty smirk to soften the blow of being outsmarted by a girl. "The coma messed up my memory, not my brain." Ned laughed, completely unembarrassed, stuffing his hands in his pockets and rocking back on his heels.
"Well, hey, a guy's gotta try, right?"
I kept the smirk since he seemed to like it.
"Keep trying."
"Okay,"
Ned said, sobering up and putting on his business face.
"Seriously, so I said 180, right? And you told me I'd have to do better than that, which you're totally breaking my bollocks here, but fair enough. And to get back to you. So I left you a note saying we can talk about 200k, right? But then you..." An uncomfortable shrug. "You know."
200k? For a second, all I felt was the pure white high of triumph. The one every detective knows when the cards turn over and you see that every bet you placed was pinpoint perfect. That flying blind, you found your way straight home. Then I realized. I had assumed Ned was the one holding things up, sorting out paperwork or trying to raise cash. Lexi had never needed serious money to run before. She had reached North Carolina with a deposit for a fleabag apartment and left it with what she got for her beaten-up car. All she'd ever asked for was an open road and a few hours' head start. This time, she had been negotiating six-figure deals with Ned. Not just because she could. With the baby growing and Abby's sharp eyes in the background and an offer that size on the table, why hang around for weeks over a few grand either way? She would have signed on the dotted line, demanded small bills and been gone, unless she needed every penny she could get. The more I had learned about Lexi, the more I had taken it for granted that she was planning on having an abortion as soon as she got to wherever she was going. Abby, and Abby had known her as well as anyone could, thought the same after all. But an abortion only costs a few hundred quid. Lexi could have saved that much from her job by this time, nicked it out of the kitty one night, got a bank loan she would never repay. No need to mess around with Ned at all. Raising a child costs a whole lot more. The princess of no man's land, the queen of 1,000 castles between worlds, had crossed over. She had been about to open her hands and take hold of the biggest commitment of all. The wall felt like it was turning to water underneath me. I must have been staring like I'd seen a ghost.
"Seriously,"
Ned said, a little miffed, misreading the look.
"I'm not messing you around. 200 G's is my absolute best offer. I mean, I'm taking a major risk here. After we're sorted, I've still got to convince at least two of your mates. I'll get in there in the end, obviously, once I've got the leverage, but that could take months and a shitload of hassle."
I pressed my free hand down on the wall hard, feeling the rough stone dig into my palm till my head cleared.
You think?
Those pale eyes widened.
Oh God, yeah. I don't know what the fuck they're doing.